Okay, I'd like to call to order the March 16th Mountain Regional Water Administrative Control Board meeting. Do we have any public inputs?
We do not.
Okay, do we need to go into executive session?
We do not.
Excellent. Okay. Then does anyone have any questions on the consent agenda? Meeting minutes, check register. It says purchase order, but I didn't see one in there.
No purchase orders.
Okay, so no purchase orders. Mike, Joel, Corey, any questions on the minutes for the check register? You know, I can't skip for the so I have a couple of questions. So it looked like we had Topcon Solutions and InfoWater subscription for $7,000.
That's the hydraulic modeling software. We're switching platforms this year. Topcon's a third-party vendor who sells Autodesk products. And
Okay.
InnoVise is an Autodesk product. So we purchased it through them.
And then we also had a WaterGems 5000 type subscription.
Yep, so the WaterGems is the product we're moving away from, and we're going to run both in parallel for part of this year
Okay.
just to have coverage. And then the plan is next year to fully move just to the InnoVise part.
And then we had $17,000 for treatment plant maintenance from Total Power and Controls.
New electrical conduits and cabling for the larger pumps that we replaced up there.
Okay. That's all I had. Any other questions on the consent agenda?
Joel shaking his head no.
Okay. Do we have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Okay. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. That's unanimous. And then we are on to the consideration and approval to award Auckland as the construction manager, general contractor of the administrative office and maintenance facility.
So in your packet, there is a outline of the CMGC RFP process that we went through with the county. And we met 2 weeks ago, representatives from the county. We also had our architect, a representative from the county's architect, GSBS. And Oakland Construction was a clear leader in their presentation and their knowledge of the project. So I'm asking for authorization to enter into contract negotiations with Oakland Construction to be our construction manager, general contractor. Steve will talk in the next item about the impact of the budget on doing that. We think there are benefits of having the CMGC involved in the process earlier rather than later. So they have proposed a team of who would be working with us, and then the goal would be to break ground about a year from now, April-ish, and then have us in our new building by June of 2025.
Okay. Are we discussing the capital budget amendment or is that separate?
That's second.
Okay.
That's, I'll discuss that as kind of part of this and how much the CMGC will cost us.
And who is WCG? It says that they're them, WCG along with Summit County. I just didn't know who that was.
Their consultant.
Yeah, there's a third party consultant that the county had hired to facilitate this process. And we're kind of in two different stages with the county. The county has seen a budget number and they're now trying to back into a building size that would fit their budget. We're not to that point yet where we're coming out of the schematic design phase right now, so we don't have a hard budget right now. But the county's taking a step back right now, trying to figure out what their project should look like. So hopefully we'll run into parallel tracks. And the county is also in favor of paying their CMGC.
So do we need a motion, or is this just a hand?
This requires, Dave, a approval to enter into negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we get to a contract, that will also require an approval. And will require a capital budget amendment, which we hope to present to the county council on the 29th of this month.
Hey, I have a question. Are we thinking at all about sharing the property with someone to reduce our costs?
We are not.
I mean, is that something we should consider or not?
Unfortunately, the property is not big enough for us to let someone else use it the way we, the maintenance building and the yard. Now, the way the building is currently being designed, it will be built, it will be overbuilt to allow for future growth. There is a possibility, if there's another county department that may be interested in using an office or two for a period of time, we could consider something like that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Andy.
Yep.
Okay. Do we have a motion to approve this, or do we have any other discussion?
So the way I'm reading it, we're looking at about $40,000 in CMGC costs. No.
1.2 million.
All right. I missed something. Because they had their cost.
There is a pre-design fee, okay, which is about 40,000.
Right. Okay.
Which you can authorize without, right? Isn't that under?
Well, we still have to enter the, negotiate the contract, and it's part of the entire bid.
Okay.
Do we think by doing this on the front end, it will reduce our costs on the back end, or?
We think there's going to be some economies of scale by using the same CMGC as the county, that they'll have, Oakland will be doing both projects. One of the things that really came out of the CMGC process is, if we hope to build a year from now, we need to start ordering HVAC equipment, some major electrical transformers and things like that, if we want to meet that time frame.
Did we consider other construction management groups?
Yes. There were four others. There were seven total that applied. There were six that applied. Two did not meet the criteria. We interviewed the top four. I think I included the scoring sheet.
Yeah, I think that was in there.
I'm getting lost in my Google Drive here, to be honest with you. It's all over the place for one reason or another. But
yes, so four were considered, and Oakland seemed to fit.
That's in at seven.
Yeah, I thought we had seven.
Yeah, there were
and
seven.
And that four went.
Interviewed four. And the other thing, by partnering with the county, they did everything through the state procurement process, and they will make the notifications as well.
I know Mike's looking back a year ago and going, see, maybe I was wrong.
What?
We are talking about the new office. Just so always seems like, you know, just seems like we're in a period of time where everything's more expensive than we thought it was going to be.
Steve, you could go over the capital budget side of things before we make a decision, if you want to walk.
Yeah, if we want to talk through that a little bit, what you guys think about that. So the capital budget, as you recall, last month we presented the infrastructure amendments. That was about $600,000. We were going to be able to come up with cash from that, from better results than we thought and a little bit of extra money we had. So we've amended that for a second reason to go back for capital budget amendment, and that is to retain a CMGC to help with the construction of the administrative building and the office maintenance shop. So that money we do not have just sitting from
revenue from last year, excess revenue or anything like that. So we would have to tap into a reserve.
Which money though?
The money to pay for the CMGC. I have it at 1.05, the 40,000 and then just under like 980,000 right in there. So it's about 1.3 million that we would pay the CMGC estimated at this point based off what the percentage they say they would take of the cut of the building and things like that.
That's the total fee.
That's their the fee.
Project. 1.3 or 1.1?
Sorry, it's just over one. It's
just one.
Yeah, it's 1.03.
1.03. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, so the fund we would use.
Five. Is that secondly one? Oh, no, that's a different. Sorry.
That's where the money's going to come from.
So secondly, the 1.05 will come from the regionalization reserve. So if you recall, when we sold the regional supply water, to Weaver Basin to sell those Summit water, we would put aside some of that money every year. That had gotten to be up to about $2.8 million. Last year, we moved roughly 800,000. Well, no, not roughly. We moved 800,000 to our drought reserve that we wanted to establish. So we still had a little over $2 million of regionalization reserve money. So we would use that to pay the CMGC. So that's where the 1.05 million. So, the regionalization reserves would become the source to fund the CMGC. And then, so we'd access another reserve and then the, capital available from previous years would cover the infrastructure piece more or less.
What were we going to use the 1.05 for?
We originally had put it aside starting in 2020. We had to start to pay a regionalization fee of $245,000 a year to Weaver Basin. We've been able to absorb that into the budget and not have to tap into that reserve to pay that fee. So we've been able to let that fee, that reserve just stay there. So now instead of borrowing or doing something else, we think it'd be a good use of that reserve to front load getting the building built or let's say retaining the CMGC to help us build. So that's where the money comes from.
Does it go for what basically 2 years though, right? Or does it cover from now till May of 25?
My understanding is their fee would cover the whole managing the duration.
So we don't have to come up with it all now.
We just have to show where the funds would come from before we enter a contract. We can't sign a contract and then say we'll find out where the money is coming from. So we're just wanting to make sure it's in the capital budget because you're authorizing the spending of the money. So we have to say where we're going to come up with it from. Kind of like when we do enter a contract to build the building, we'll have to say we're going to get money through bonding or a loan or whatever to pay for the building, even though we won't necessarily be paying it all up front. So this is identifying that we do have the means to pay for it.
That's why we got to do the budget.
And that's why we have to do the budget amendment.
As another side note, we own the other side of this building, and we did get a third-party appraisal today at $1,350,000. So it's not like we're taking this cash out of a regionalization fund or depleting that. We do have other means of replacing that when we move. And we do have interest from a couple of county departments about purchasing that.
I didn't know. I thought we rented.
We rent this side. We own that side.
Okay.
So do we ever anticipate that regionalization reserve being needed for something else that it was originally earmarked for?
No, because the way we kind of rolled that into our budget, it would just become, now that it's part of our budget, it would become part of any rate increase we would do. So this reserve, as it started to kind of work out that way, we always knew we kind of had this reserve set aside that could help us with a big project like building a building or things like that. So it's just finally allocating it to that. I mean, we would be spending money that we have in reserve. So we couldn't use it for something else. It's no longer in the reserve. So yeah, let's hope something else wouldn't come up, but I guess the real question is the value of the CMGC worth $1 million to us. We've asked total project cost is estimated between 10 and 15 million. I think their costs are more driven by the 15 million than the 10.
Yeah.
But we're hoping that as we start to design our maintenance shop and office, there's a lot of cushion, let's say, or contingencies in the early budgeting of the building. So, I mean, we don't know for sure, but I don't think it'll be 15. I think it'll be closer to 10 to 12. But that's kind of the area we're operating in. So we're basically paying the architects about 10% and the CMGC about 10% of what the estimated final cost of the building would be.
Does that completely deplete our regionalization reserves?
No, it'll leave a little over $1 million in there still.
Okay.
And what's the goal for what's left over?
It's the board's discretion.
Yeah.
It's the reserve that we set up a while ago when we started doing the regionalization, selling the regionalization model.
Mm-hmm.
And like Steve mentioned, it was originally set up to help cover some of the costs of these fees that we were going to be incurring. What happened, why we probably didn't need it as soon as we thought we did, we grew so fast and we started adding customers way faster than we thought we were. So that regionalization reserve that we'd set aside to kind of use when we knew those fees were coming down the pipe, we really didn't need them because we added so many new customers that it kind of offset the need to use that reserve. We didn't have to use the reserve as soon as we thought we were going to. And so we've been able to have it kind of sit there as a, a rainy day fund, if you will, but
yeah.
To kind of, we knew we had a building coming. If we had, and we have other reserves for other things. We have capital repair reserves. We have treatment plant reserves, but this is one that we had just set aside because of the wholesale water sales that we were able to do. And at one point in time, we could use that reserve to help fund the building, to help do a project.
Chris, would you mind bringing up my summary report? And we can maybe just talk about the cash section of that real quick so you can kind of see this. Yeah, so if you scroll down a few pages, there's a cash part of this report.
I thought the regionalization was anticipating a regionalization project, like the importation project or a bald pipeline or like infrastructure associated with our agreement with Leader Basin that we would, you know, have, if they came up with a project, we'd have to participate.
I think that was a lot further down the road. And this original.
Into the future?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think this original one was to help with those fees that came on, the $250,000 that we had to pay for the regionalization of reserve fees. So that was the
and
initial.
To Weber Basin.
Yep.
To
Weber Basin. So cash right now, so the reserve, you'll see the regionalization reserve that's at 2.1 million. About five lines down, and then the drought reserve, that's where the funds would come out of, is that 2.1 million. We have other reserves, like Lisa was mentioning, our capital facility reserves, you know, to help with, repair and replace type things. About 1.8 of that is sitting in a separate fund. Then there's funds for Lost Canyon, funds for the treatment plant.
Did you just take that 2.1 divided by 2 to get 1.05? Is that?
No, it just happened to work out that way, that basically the CMGC, their early estimates add up to 1.05.
I thought the contractor was 1.4.
I probably misspoke when I originally said that.
For the CMGC.
Yeah. The CMGC is 1.0. Well, we're going to budget 1.05. Their estimate is about 1.03.
So I thought it was, we were taking 1.05 from here and another 300 and something to get the 1.4.
So there's two different things.
Yeah.
There's the amendment to the infrastructure agreement, which the board did approve last month. And then there's this portion.
Is it this? Yeah. I think it's this. The 1.4 is how much we're adding to the budget. We have set aside quite a bit of money for the building already.
Last month, I kind of had that sheet that showed all the money we'd set aside and how we'd spend it.
You're at, to which budget are you at? 1.4 million.
To our capital budget. So we have to add, and that's basically all going to building the land in Memphis. We have some left over from what we'd already allocated. So the 350 covers the difference between what we've already allocated and the 600,000 the infrastructure is going to cost. And then the remainder is to pay for the CMGC. So the amendment is only 1.4. And then there's the two sources. Source one source is just funds from previous years. Basically, results last year were better than originally projected. And then the second part of that comes out of the fund.
I think maybe it just got confusing because the other one was already approved last month.
Yeah, and I was
right. So the 350 was in last month. There's not another 350.
That hasn't been fully approved yet because that has to go to county.
Yeah, and it will go as a combined thing to county council since they haven't seen the 350 yet. Because once we knew the CMGC was coming, we said, "Well, let's wait and then just go to the council once."
And the council knows that the 350 is coming. Because they initiated that
infrastructure agreement.
Okay, so we've got a building budget of roughly 15 million. And now we're looking to add another million. If we have a crystal ball, do we see the building budget number coming back towards 15 million as a result of having the CMGC? Or do we think that we've just kind of add in an extra million and maybe it'll get delivered a little earlier?
I don't think it'll get delivered any earlier, but we're in an environment where construction costs are actually coming down, but I can't promise where things are going to be a year from now.
Right.
So it is possible that this could add another $1 million. So we either go to the CMGC, the Construction Management General Contract, or we keep moving along the path and we take our chances a year from now in hiring a construction company, and then we would have to figure out who could manage that process. We do not have the staff, the time, the talent.
But a construction manager was not previously in the budget for the building.
It was contemplated that we were going to go down this route. And so when we issued the RFP with the county, we issued it that we were not required. So if the county went ahead and awarded something, we were not required to select the same CMGC. We were not obligated to select a CMGC. I think it's in the best interest of the district to go down this route. The CMGC process is something that the county has done more frequently lately because of some of the other projects they've been on, and Dave may be able to speak to that. They've kind of gotten burnt on. So this will help. This will be our representative kind of in the continued design process and then boots on the ground when construction starts.
Yeah. I'm just trying to determine if the budget is ballooning right now or if this was kind of part of the plan and I'm coming in late to the game.
No, I mean, that's the other thing. We do not have a hard number on where we think our building is going to be last week or two weeks ago. We went and toured some facilities within the state. There was in West Bountiful, there was a shop building that was being built for about $5.5 million. And then we saw some other buildings that are maybe in that same similar $5.6 million or so, maybe $11 million. So it could come off of that $15 million number, but I'm not going to tell you it's going to be $9 million and when it's really going to be 15. I'd rather tell you it's 15 and hope it's less.
Mm-hmm. So, right, the way that, does that contract require them to give us a guaranteed maximum price in CMGC?
I don't know on that in the CMGC world.
Ultimately, yes.
Guaranteed maximum price.
So have you looked at the contract, the CMGC contract with Oakland?
We're asking to enter into negotiations create a contract.
Yeah, we're going to use the AIA contract. But yeah, I mean, once you give the go ahead, we will negotiate the terms of that. ultimately bring it back to you guys. And then, well, but, I mean, that's the, yeah. We'll bring it back to you, and then ultimately, the in terms of the process, there is a time period after you award that for them to come up with the guaranteed maximum price.
30% or 60% is kind of typical.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole risk part of it of what if costs go up, do they take those, or if they go down,
those are, cover up. Yeah, that's part of working out the, you know, the deal points. I mean, the county, when the county did the Richens building, we didn't have a CMGC, and I think we ended up paying a price on that because it came in 2 years late. We ended up having to sue the contractor and get somebody else to finish the contract. And I think part of that is because, you know, the county didn't have the expertise on a major project like that to have somebody there to make sure everything got done.
Do you remember what the contract company was? The change?
I think back then it was about $6 or $7 million. And
it's a significant effort.
Yeah, I mean, as a result of that, the county then did a CMGC for the new library in Camas. And, you know, and there were issues with that. But because of that way we did the contract, we were able to get by a lot of the problems that were had with some of the contractors. And I think from that experience, the county decided, you know, for these big projects, this is probably the way to go. And as a result of that, High Valley Transit did a CMGC contract with Big D to build their complex. And they provided the explanation to FTA for putting in some of the funds, and FTA gave them the go-ahead to use that form of contract. So that's what they've done.
Sorry, Dave, question on the High Valley Transit. So Big D is the CMGC. Who is the construction company that there is actually building?
Big D.
Big D. So Big D is playing both roles.
And that would be the same with us.
So yeah. They perform the same role, and there are various protections built in. It acts almost as a design build type of a deal.
Okay.
I mean, the nice thing is that Big D's on the hook for hiring the subs.
Yeah.
So it would be the same thing. Oakland would be hiring all the subs as our representative, essentially, right?
Okay. So basically, we would not go out for an RFP for construction.
Correct.
We're done.
Yep. That's the whole point.
Okay. Just making sure.
Yeah.
And the idea is that built into the guaranteed maximum price is, you know, the most you're going to pay. And if, depending on how we negotiate it, I know with Big D and High Valley, it was negotiated in such a way that there were protections built in case supply chain problems and other things that came in, so that High Valley wasn't taking that risk. Big D was taking the risk. And we'll need to build those same type provisions into this contract as well.
That's the hard part, that getting that balance.
Yeah,
I mean, it's money for them to take.
It does. And so it took us 2 months to negotiate with Big D. And your architect is part of that, part of the team that negotiates. And you'll find that contractors and architects have a natural tension between them.
Diametrically opposed.
Discovered that, yeah.
And so, you know, in terms of the negotiations we did for Highway Number Transit, you know, it was a process of going back and forth between all three of them, Big D, the architect, and High Valley Transit, to try to work it out in terms of getting an agreement that everybody could be comfortable with and understand, you know, what the lines of authority was.
I think from the staff standpoint, the CMGC process is appealing to us because none of us are contractors or builders, right? So our hope is that Oakland or whoever we end up working with is looking out for our best interest. So the architect has some design that's, you know, they have some feature that's going to cost, you know, X amount. And the contractor says, well, that's silly. You don't need to do that. You can get the same effect by doing this. And so it may not necessarily be a large cost savings, but it's going to be probably a better product, a more livable space for us for things that we don't know about. You know, we don't, like Andy said, we don't have the expertise in house. That's why we want to hire this group to represent us and our best interest.
And the county also has a owner's representative that, you know, basically is looking at the entire Gilmore site for everybody that's constructing there to try to make sure that everyone is behaving.
That helps a bunch.
It does. I mean, I think between that person and Chris Robinson, who got involved in the issues over the excavation and the cost of the excavations and bringing down those costs, I think that was important to have, you know, that owner's rep involved who could negotiate with Big D Construction and everything else that's happening on the site.
So it's just up to the board if you're willing to allow us to enter into contract negotiation with Oakland. And then it would require that capital budget amendment as well.
Yeah, that all seems reasonable to me.
You're willing to make
it does seem like having this entity in place. Going into it is going to give us probably a better building, and it will probably help us control costs. So it seems like a big number up front, but I really think it's going to probably benefit us in the long run.
Yeah. The other entities over there, actually, I mean, Tim Doherty originally brought this up in the very beginning. He was an advocate of doing that. So we kind of started down that path from a conversation we had with him last year.
Okay, so are you ready for a motion?
Yes, so we need a motion.
I have a couple of questions. And it doesn't matter to me who answers this. Number one is, are we going to build something that we're going to add, we can add on to for either expansion, growth, or maybe new technologies or whatever? I mean,
yeah, both buildings, Joel, are being designed, anticipating an addition on both at some point in the future.
Okay, that's what I thought you had said that before, but I just wanted to make sure. I think that's all I have right at this point.
And so what I had said is that the way the administration building is being designed right now, it is being built with some extra space in it, so we can expand without having to do an addition.
Okay.
But we think the shop space will be maximized as being drawn.
Yeah, I mean, it really would be nice if we could predict the future. The other question I have is it going to be one story or two stories? Or have we planned to grow up, so to speak.
The building, the administration building is a one-story building. The maintenance building is maximum height of 32 feet with a mezzanine built into it. So it wouldn't be a true two-story building, but there will be some storage in one of the bays.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have a motion to approve this?
I think we have a motion to have Andy enter into negotiations with Oakland for the CMGC. Do we need
a second?
So you can do that as one motion, and then the motion to recommend the capital budget amendment to the county council.
Gotcha.
Do you have a preference?
You started the one, so I'd finish that and then just do
okay.
That.
Yeah. So, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. That's unanimous. And then do we have a motion to approve the capital budget changes?
So.
Do we have a second?
Aye.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Okay. So unanimous on both, but thank you for letting us talk that out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Lucky we set aside that money for a rainy day, that's for sure.
Yes.
Okay.
So I think we're to the February results. Top page. Numero uno. So we're doing better than we originally budgeted. We're at net position or net income for the year so far of $48,200. We budgeted having lost $300,000 by this point, so we're ahead of budget by $348,000. It's a combination of revenue and expense savings. The revenue is $192,000 above budget. The majority of that is coming from interest income. Even though we really ramped it up, interest rates, we're getting paid 4.5% to 5%, about 4.6 right now out of our PTIF fund. Wow. So, Chris, you want to scroll down just a little bit.
What's PTIF?
Public Investment.
Go ahead. Public Treasure Investment Fund.
Is that the 401?
It's the state.
It's the state where it's basically only government agencies can put money in here to make more than a typical savings account.
Okay.
And so we just keep our money.
Like a savings.
It's just like a savings account. But it returns better. So if you see the variance for revenue, you can see the $105,000 in that other revenue line. That's basically interest income is really running hot. The other variance that's kind of big you'll see there is retail water sales. And I talked about this a little bit. When we projected the rates and the budget for 2023, we had a certain number of customers we thought would be using water and a certain number that would be on standby. That whole thing shifted a little. I've got more customers actually already connected to water, and we've replaced the standby units with new lots that are being platted. So our revenue is running a little better than what had been projected in the 2023 budget, which is a good thing, because as you look outside, we're going to probably lose all of May outside watering, and I would guess half of June, because just by the time the snow melts and things like that. So what we're ahead, I don't know if we'll hold. So on the expense side, operations, maintenance and repairs and non-operation maintenance and repairs are both running below budget. Depreciation is running a little bit below budget because we didn't absorb some of the assets we thought we were going to from developers. So our depreciation isn't as high. That's always a best estimate on how much it will primarily complete and become our assets, how much of Silver Creek will get completed and become our assets, because that drives depreciation. If you look to the right, you'll see the change is more noticeable in non-OM&R, where it's up 18% over last year. And that's because those budgets are very payroll sensitive, in that most of that their budgets are payroll, whereas operations has a lot of other things, all the supplies, repairs, parts. So we're right now, even they had the same rate increase. I mean, we don't pay employees different. They would be asking Mayor and Cola type of thing, but they haven't spent as much money on some of those things as we thought early in the year. meter replacements, some distribution line. I think I called them out a little bit lower. So overall, we're running really close to budget for expenses.
So, Steve, yeah. So we have staff or our labor costs are in both up
yeah.
two lines.
Yeah.
Why do you do that? Why don't you just keep them all in one?
Because we have always established it that way and track expenses that way, and that's how we report it to Fitch and to the budget. It's always by department, not by just payroll and other expenses.
Department costs,
okay. We also cost share with Park City and Lost Canyon.
So some things have to be kind of called out, broken out, because of some of the contracts we have to share costs with Park City, Wheeling, with Lost okay. Canyon, and things like that. Okay, that's kind of all that's important there. Cash, we kind of hit. We do have almost $24 million in the bank. The debt reserves held by the district is $7 million. $5 million of that plus is impact fees, which we'll be able to use part of those for the building and part of those for whatever we end up doing at the treatment plant. The debt reserves held by the trustee that goes up every month, that's where we make our bond payments out of. That we talked about last month. Yes, Karen.
I saw that, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, but we transferred $150,000 from the impact fee fund to make bond payments. Is that just the impact fee?
At the beginning of the year, when we set up an impact, there's the last impact fee analysis we did says uh-huh. you can use this much to pay debt.
Okay.
We could take that up to that much out if we wanted. What we usually do is whatever we budget for impact fees, we take out to help just with cash flow. Basically, it helps move restricted funds into non-restricted funds that we can use for whatever we want. So this year, our budget's $600,000. So we transfer $150,000 out 4 months just to kind of help cash flow early in the year because we don't have the revenue of summer yet, but we still have expenses.
So we'll transfer a total of 600 out.
A total of 600 over 4 months.
And we'll just, so are we going to do it like through the first 4 months? Or are we going to do it?
I didn't do it in January, so we're going to do it February, March, April.
Gotcha. Okay.
I didn't have any impact fees to transfer. And then the reserves we talked about kind of below there. So strong cash position, but we are going to, the cash has been growing. As you see, it's going to start going the other way for a little while as we do projects in Summit Park, as we start building the building, all these things. Customer growth, this is where we see the impact. We saw at the end of 2022, new people requesting building permits, paying an impact fee has just dried up. We have 5 so far this year through February. Last year through February, we were at 40. And in 2021, we were at 57. So
how many have we had in March so far?
4, and they were all promontory. So not much money. Yeah. I signed a lot, though, this week, so hopefully. But a lot of them are remodels, which isn't a lot of money usually. Over on the right side, you'll see promontory has sold 3 lots so far this year or through February. And the last 2 years, they were at 11 and 18. So, again, all the construction you're seeing happen is stuff that people started in 21 or 22. We're not early 22. People aren't coming in and wanting to start new construction right now.
Are you seeing anything different, Karen, in the real estate world?
No, but, you know, now that the banks are starting to get jittery, you know, people think people are going to either go into real estate or gold. And, you know, it might make the Fed a little less aggressive on raising interest rates. So, I mean, those could be good things actually for the real estate industry.
Interesting.
Okay. So I guess on back to that one. This one? Yeah, this is good. How does it make you feel about our projection of the collections and impact if we go down 73%?
No,
go ahead.
We only budgeted 600,000, so it's not a crazy attainable number. The one good thing is
because the last how many years we've been over $1 million or
yeah,
a million.
You can. Oh yeah, it doesn't show the other guy.
But
we were 3.3 million, 3.4 million in 2021. We were 1.7 million last year, and we dropped it all the way down to 600,000 because we we could kind of see this coming the end of last year. The other thing that might be a factor is nobody's pulling a building permit when there's 4 feet of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
So we might have a lot of people just on the side, like, well, I'm not going to start building until June anyway. Why am I going to start giving money? And so our summer months are always our biggest months. And then right as you finish into fall, a lot of people usually pay their impact fee and kind of start construction, try to get ground broken before winter. So I think we could still get to 600,000. But it's just that right now we're starting a little slower than normal, but the year always starts slow.
Yeah.
But except for 2021. Well, what's funny is 2021 started not crazy, but that was when people were still kind of figuring out COVID, and then it ballooned like crazy. And then 2022, the first half of 2022 was even busier than 2021, but then it just died the second half. Because if you look at the 126,000, that was through February last year, and the 85,000 was through February 2021. And right now we're at 23,000. So we'll keep watching that. But the other good thing is Silver Creek back here. A lot of that, you knew, were prepaids from Matt Lowe. He's almost used up all of those. So a lot of this back here, they're going to have to start to pay at least a portion of the impact fee. Whereas before it was all covered, the prepaids he has now that he bought from somebody else only cover about half the impact fee. So where we weren't getting much money from back here, we'll start to at least see some come in. All right.
Thanks.
Moving down, usage is still down a little bit compared to last year by our customers, about 5 acre feet, 4% down over the years. The one usage that was very different was Olympic Park, took almost 3 million gallons. In February, historically, they've only taken about one. So I think they're still, as my understanding, testing out their new pond and being able to make snow and cover all that land that they're turning into ski runs. So yeah, this number gets much more interesting as we hit summer. Okay. Let's scroll down a little bit because I think the next graph kind of shows. So that blue line is revenue so far this year. As you can see, it's higher. It's higher by about 12.5%, which is our rate increase about 8-9%, because a lot of this is still with just base, and then growth of about 3.5% or 4%. So that's why we're running higher. So we'll watch that trend. It should run higher throughout the year unless we get a really, where usage is really off. For example, in May, you see how revenue usually starts to tick up. Maybe scroll up just a little so they can see the months. It'll probably stay flat, or we'll probably hit about those numbers because of rate increases. And then we'll just have to see how June, July, and August play out with what behaviors have changed. Cause all the indications is that Weber Basin won't put restrictions on us. We won't put restrictions for how drought rates either. So it'll be more of a normal year other than that there's a ton of snow on the ground right now. Okay. Down a little bit, and just sales by category, you can kind of see, we're running higher in residential than originally projected. And the wholesale, that's basically the Olympic Park water that they take 3 million gallons instead of a million. So that's why we're rolling up there.
Just a quick aside for the new guy. Who or what is Park City Wheeling?
I'll take it. Okay. So our Lost Canyon system, the big pump station off the river that brings water up to the top of Promontory to our treatment plant. Park City owns 43.9% of that system. As that, they're entitled to about 2,900 acre feet of water out of the river that they use Lost Canyon and we pump it to them. We charge them basically the cost to do that, and then they pay in also to support Lost Canyon's operations, like Lisa was kind of saying earlier. That's why we keep that separate, because they have to pay our staff to be there kind of thing and maintain it. So it's a wheeling charge in that it's really low, because it's basically power and just cost to get that water over to them because they do own part of the system.
Yeah. So wheeling meaning we're just moving the water for them.
Where's their water, part, isn't it?
What?
Their water.
Yeah. They pay the lease fees separately directly to Weber Basin. It's not part of our lease fee.
It's just
how to get their water.
Time and materials to get it there.
To Wheeler.
But there's also a wheeling charge that's assessed at the Olympic Park because it's our infrastructure and some of water's water that goes through that.
That's in the wholesale line. That's where we classify that. That's why that was so thought about, Jamie. But yeah, that's a good question because that is a big part of when you look at water for the year, basically between what we send to Park City and what's used as raw water for Promontory, that's about half of our water. And the other half goes to the rest of the district. Right, Sam?
Nailed it.
Thank you. All right. I think that's it, unless there's other questions about the financial update through February. Okay. Yeah. Audit's going well. Dana, our auditor's coming up next Thursday. We've been doing a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, the PDFs.
But yeah, everything's looking good. Okay, do we want to?
Oh, yeah.
Should I cover this? Is this the next?
Did you want to?
Yeah, maybe pull up the other sheet. Or should, do we want to talk about that right now or later?
I would do it on the agenda. Where it's agenda.
It's not agenda yet. Teaser.
Yeah. I'll just go over these quick because I know we have the training still. This just a quick drought update. So, sorry, that's not fitting very well there. Anyway, this is what I showed you in January of 2017, and this is where we are as of today. So you can see conditions have improved on this drought monitor, the most significant probably being this deeper orange color, which would indicate the severe drought, has now gone to more of this moderate drought. We have much more of this in the state and getting some of this abnormally dry and even a tiny little none over there. So this is all good news. Like we said, we're not out of the woods, but we're headed in the right direction as long as it doesn't get too hot too fast. Two, this is where we are with, we're still water equivalent right now. I pulled this today, so we're at 174%, in the Weber Ogden Basin. Tooele's 207. We're all still really, really high, and I know there's still more storms coming next week. So, and I think down south is pretty good too. Yeah, 200 on the same range. On the next one, the number three, that's this curve that I showed before. This is the Weber Ogden drainage. So you can see we were like around here last week, and then this is where we've gone with the storms that came over this last week. So we're still just off the charts with where we could potentially end up. Really, really good news. So,
because the purple is all time high, right?
Yes.
And there's actually a reasonable projection will be better than
that. Well, max projection. And this is a min. So here's where they say our that's your median
peak.
Yeah, your median peak, and we're like even our worst, we're already above it. So yeah, so all really, really good. I just wanted to. Any questions on that or any other? Okay. We have been talking about the turf removal program.
Yeah.
I threw like a slideshow in there.
Yeah, I thought there was a slide in there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you got it.
I dropped it into Google.
Yeah, it's a different program. That's what I meant.
Okay, sorry. I just wanted to go over what we have preliminarily talked about. We are meeting, our Mountain Regional staff and Weber Basin staff will be meeting next week to kind of tighten up where we think we want to be. All the drafts that I had in there were stuff that we've already gone through with Weber Basin, but after the legislature's closed and we know what the state is kind of requiring for funding, we want to make sure we align with that so that we can leverage those funds from the state and from Weber Basin and from the money that we've set aside. So the program process, really quick, this is kind of what the customer will see. We'll kick it off. Their first step would be to measure their project area. They'll create a landscape plan based on the measurements they took in step one. And in that plan, their perennial plants must cover 50% at maturity of the project area. And this is coming from more of a state mandated number. So we need to follow what the state is asking for in order to get, like I said, leverage that funding. Everything will be going through Utah Water Savers, which is where everyone in the state of Utah will be going. What will happen is each of the conservancy districts will manage their section of that portal with their people. And that's all managed by Weber Basin. So Mountain Regional won't have to do any of the administrative tasks on that end. That will all be handled by Weber Basin. What Mountain Regional staff will do is do an on-site visit of the customer who has submitted their project area and their landscape plan and completed the application. Mountain Regional would then approve this participation agreement and their site plan, and that project that they have laid out must be completed within 1 year of that approval date. So we want to give people time, but we don't want this dragging on forever. Once they have finished it, they return back to the Utah Water Savers site, and they would submit photos and receipts and request a final inspection, which would be done by Mountain Regional staff. After the inspection is done, then they would complete a W-9 and a rebate check would be mailed to them. So that's the process that we're currently looking at rolling out. I don't see this changing significantly. There may be maybe a few tweaks here and there. Go to the next one. I think as far as scope of services between Mountain Regional and Weber Basin, I talked a little bit about that. Utah Water Savers is separate. Mountain Regional will do kind of the boots on the ground here with customers in the district. Weber Basin will do all the administrative side. Weber Basin is asking that Mountain Regional reimburse customers for the full amount, and then Mountain Regional will invoice Weber Basin for the other two-thirds of the cost, one-third being from Weber Basin's funds and the other third being from the state's funds. So if we go to the next slide. I'll go through it. So right now, these are kind of some of the open items that we're still contemplating. A lot of them have just kind of financial implications of what we're looking at as far as getting a reimbursement per square foot to customer. So right now, the amount of the reimbursement we're looking at is about $3 to $4. So if we went for the $4 side, the maximum the state will reimburse right now is $1.50. That's the max they will do. If that being the case, Weber Basin would match that $1.50. So we're at $3, and Mountain Regional could do another dollar to get you to $4 per square foot, which is a pretty good chunk if you were going to, you know, do some kind of turf removal as far as cost goes. And I'll go to a slide that we can look at about where we see some of that cost being. Weber Basin is estimating they'll have about $100,000 available to Mountain Regional. And as you know, we've allocated $200,000 from our drought reserve fund, out of our drought reserve fund. So we're also talking about maximums. I believe the state has hit a max per customer of $50,000. So that would be the most we could reimburse to somebody. Weber Basin is also discussing a potential 50-50 cost share with commercial industrial customers. I have not seen any additional information from Weber Basin on this yet, and this is something we're going to talk about next week. So this is Park City used this in one of their, when they were doing their turf removal program. They talked to three different landscapers, and they got an idea of what it might cost per square foot for somebody to do a turf removal project. So this is based on 1,000 square foot of property. They did a minimum effort, which would be tier one, an average effort, which would be a nice retrofit and an average level of effort. And then they had kind of a high end, something you'd expect to see in Upper Deer Valley or some maybe Colony or Northridge or something. So they asked three different landscapers. These landscapers are in different colors. You can see, you know, you had quite a price range from $1 to $2 a square foot for this kind of landscaper on the lower end for a real minimal effort. I probably imagine, and I think somebody in here this landscaper mentioned that most of his client base sees an 80% of an average tier. So most people are doing something in the average, which would be a nice retrofit and, if possible, you know, an average level effort of what they're doing. So they're doing a nice job. It's not, you know, all the bells and whistles, but it's not just, you know, round up and mulch, basically. So if we look at this average tier two, we're probably at, like, this landscaper says 2 to 4, 4 to 6 for an average, or a 6 to 7 for the higher end. So if we're landing at a $4 square foot, you could maybe do the whole thing for what we're going to pay you. If you want to do a little bit more, then you would share a little bit more in the cost, and maybe you take on the additional $2. If you want something really nice, then we're probably going to end up in the half, you know, it's like more like a 50-50 split. So, did I put on the next page, Chris, or was that it?
That's the last page.
Okay. So, I think right now, like I said, we're kind of in the preliminary stage. We've gone back and forth about what we thought the maximum reimbursement could be for residential and commercial. Right now, we've come up with, I don't have it on there, but we're thinking 15. We decided to do separate maximums for each. 15,000 for a residential would be the maximum amount, and 50,000 for commercial. So if you do the
math, all, that's everybody in.
That's all in.
So we're only a third of that.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Okay.
Or less, actually. If they do $1.50, $1.50, and we only do a dollar, then it's not quite.
But the maximum that you can totally reimburse is 50,000. So if we had four, you know, well, I guess if you, for 400,000, if Weber Basin does 100, the state does 100, well, that wouldn't get us there. But if you took the $400,000 pot, let's say, 8 people could get it. If we did really big retrofits on, you know, commercial industrial spaces. You know, HOAs wanting to do stuff, I could see that happening.
Or even like the Triumph plant has so much grass.
Yeah. So that I could see being, that would be a, you know, $50,000. Are we going to have others that are going to do water, you know, smaller stuff? 100%. And I want to make sure that we are meeting the needs of what those residential customers are going to be looking for. And I think the 15,000 kind of hits the spot. But I'm open to suggestions, or if you think you'd like me to take other ideas to Weber Basin, excuse me, or if you had other thoughts about the program.
I thought I saw something that said like the minimum was 200 square feet. And let's say you just did like your parking strip. Mm-hmm. Would that?
It just has to be a minimum of 200 square feet.
Yeah.
So I don't know how big it's.
10 by 20? Yeah, 10 by 20 is not very big.
That's not
big.
Yeah, I was thinking it might be 50 feet by 6 feet wide for a parking strip, 300 square feet.
Okay.
And that it costs $6. You know, it costs $7,200. So you'd get two-thirds of that back.
Yeah.
I don't have any grass. But if I did, I'd rip it all out for
you. Yeah, smart. So I kind of ran through this in my head, just wondering what it would take to do my backyard, because I've got about 600 square feet of grass. My biggest gripe is if I tear out my grass, I would want to put turf back in. But according to this, I've got to rip out half of the grass that I rip out. I have to put plants in.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just put turf where I had grass. That's a non-starter for me.
Okay.
When you're saying you're replacing
turf doesn't qualify as part of it. Yeah. So, and that's just the state. That is the state. That's what they're driving that.
Right.
So some people do want to do AstroTurf, then that wouldn't be.
You know, and the other thing is we're requiring a landscaping plan ahead of time for what it's going to look like when it's done. And if it is a super simple project, that's adding, you know, if somebody's just got a postage stamp of a backyard in Silver Creek Village or whatever, and they're going, well, now I've got to hire a landscape architect for $2,000 so that I can get $2,000 back from Mountain Region of Water. What's the point?
I don't think anywhere we looked at, there's nowhere that says it has to be a landscape architect.
Well, sure.
I mean, it could be.
You could get a Google map and say, I'm going to take this out and reflect with that.
And there are Localscapes is a Utah company that does, you know, site design. And they have really simple, you know, like, you know, do it yourself, if you will, and kind of sketch out your thing. And then you say, oh, I'm going to put this plant here. And we're not asking for really elaborate drawings here. I think it's, you know, are you putting, we don't want to make this so prohibitive and so many hoops to jump through that people don't do it.
Yeah.
So I'd say we're not asking for anything.
Like I said,
you would have to charge an architect.
Just running it through my own brain going, if I were going to do this in my backyard, what are the things that I would look at that would go, okay, it's not for me.
Mm-hmm. See, yeah. I was surprised when he said that AstroTurf doesn't qualify at all.
There are issues with AstroTurf. I mean, it can be hot. It can generate. Yeah, it's not necessarily the best thing. Yeah. But Utah State Extension, Kelly Kopp is up here. She's willing to come help people. So I think there's going to be other resources that are going to be available to people. And like I said, you just need to design and tell us what you want to do. We'll go out and inspect it to make sure that, you know, if you're going to put in drought tolerant plants that are there, you're not putting in something that's going to consume a lot of water.
That's where it's going to get interesting is the difference between the plant and what gets built.
Yeah. And
does it comply, right? Then how do you decide?
Yeah, and that's going to be the, you know, the initial plan you can have, and then we'll go back and do a final inspection. Now, are we going to go back and inspect it again after it's gone to maturity? And are we going to get out and measure 50%? Probably not. But I don't, you know, we're just trying to get people to start thinking about making some of these changes for their local, to their landscapes. And, you know, I think this is not, this is not going to save the Great Salt Lake. You know, this is one tool in, you know, the toolbox, if you will, that the state has committed to some funding for. This is not tens of millions of dollars. They did $6 million last year. I think in my note, they asked for another $10 million. The state only ended up funding $3 million. They know this is not going to solve the problem. But it's a really good way to help educate, to help engage the community, in my opinion. And to help get maybe neighbors thinking about other ideas of what they can do. If you see your neighbor do it and you go, oh, that actually looks kind of good. And I think I could do that.
Right.
Then maybe you get the word out a little more in your neighborhoods. It's a way for us to engage with HOAs, to maybe engage with Triumph, to try to just do a little bit more education and be an advocate for conservation and, you know, water management in our community.
But I think, unfortunately, I think because of our snowpack, the state backed off on the funding. I think if we had a horrible winter, you would have seen more
funds
allocated.
There would have been more water bills. I mean, I think the whole water bills kind of fell flat this year because of that. And the Colorado's also getting kind of pushed down the road. But anyway, stay tuned. No decisions to be made. Hopefully I'll come to you next month with a final program.
Was this part of the two? Oh yeah, that was the.
That
was,
no, yeah, I agree with that.
Is this next on the agenda?
I think it's Andy's comments.
Okay.
The other thing too is the rain barrels for this year kicked off yesterday. If you haven't had it, if you didn't get one last year and are interested this year, that kicked off on Tuesday. Last month, several of us went, I guess it was actually the end of February, beginning of March, several of us went down to Rural Water. Jackie Jeff, one of our customer service people, was able to go through and get her operator one training, and she passed the test. Different people attended different seminars. Nothing really came out from the state or the national level. Everyone still is concerned about, you know, the drought. We shouldn't rest on our snowpack. And then Lisa, Steve, and I will be going down to the Water Users Conference Sunday through next Wednesday, where we hope to be able to speak to some of the Weber Basin people and things like that. Yesterday, we spent half a day revisiting our strategic plan that was written in 2019. If you haven't had a chance to read it lately, we're going to try to slim it down and make it a document that is easily understandable and readable. I kind of think 69-page strategic document is overkill. So I want to make sure that we present a document that it is understandable. So with that said, we're going to continue to go through that. We'll look at our vision
our mission statement's the same, but we will want to schedule a time later on, and probably in the fall, to have a board retreat to finish this up. When the document was written in 2019, it said that it should be revisited again in 2024. So we're kind of ahead of that, but we've started down that road.
So it's not going to be June 1st.
No, I don't think we can get that done.
So I have two seniors graduating. Probably not going to work out for me anyway.
Yeah, no, we don't think it makes sense to try to rush it since we're ahead of the time.
That was in 19 when we did that.
It was. Yeah.
My how time flies, right?
Mr. Thomas?
Time for elections.
Karen, I do think Ian.
Yes, I talked to Ian. You know, Ian realizes that by not being here, he'll be stuck with whatever he gets, but he would like to be considered to remain as vice chairman. So.
How do we go back?
You gotta give Steve a new logo.
What was the
point? So this is Dave's presentation. Yeah. We're waiting to address the board, officers, and elections.
You want to do the elections first?
Yeah, we gotta do all the elections.
Oh, first. Sorry. About... Okay.
Sorry. You know, 1 year we just said let's keep everything the same.
We did. We did. Well, we don't have
So
Tim.
Tim's position on the personnel committee.
Corey, is there anything that strikes your fancy on my?
I feel like I'm the kid who's new to gym class and doesn't know what team's getting picked for.
So clearly the chair is Karen. The vice chair is Ian. The audit and finance chair is Karen.
Is me.
The audit committee is the entire board member. The conservation chair is Ian.
Yes.
The personnel committee is Joel, and it was Tim.
And then do we have more than one person on the conservation committee? We definitely have two on the personnel committee.
I think we just have one on the chair, and then everybody kind of talks about conservation.
That's what I'm saying. Do we need two people on the personnel committee?
I think that the personnel committee has to have three, with Dave Warnock being one of the three. So the board does need to supply two.
And do we have one now?
Just Joel right now.
Joel. So we need one more there to replace Tim.
Yes.
Seems correct. Like that's either me or Corey.
Right.
Well, I would do that if you want to get your feet underneath him.
I have no qualms either way.
Well, you're welcome to it.
I feel like, you know, you guys are flashing this big fancy position with no job description in front of me. So
exactly.
The personnel issues.
So we have a lot of personal issues anyway, so. No, personnel, not person.
Right, basically, he needs to do Andy's annual review. What else?
I don't know. I've never been on the personnel.
If there are any other issues in the district.
Yeah, so if a staff member mm-hmm. doesn't feel like they can go to Andy, they can go to the personnel committee.
Right.
That would be their next step. So, but I don't know if that's happened.
Not since I've been here.
Well, not since Andy's
gone. At least not that Andy knows.
Does somebody want to make a motion then to do all that? To leave it the same and Mike to the personnel committee.
So moved.
Okay. Do we have a second? Okay. All in favor? Aye. Joel? Joel, are you there?
Yeah, you're muted.
Aye.
Okay, it's unanimous. Okay, great. It looks like we've got the credit limit for the credit cards.
So the board has to approve the overall credit limit for the credit cards that we have. It's 100,000 we're asking at this point in time. That's what we have set up with Zions. That's what you approved last year. The one kind of addition to this is our policies only allow us up to 10,000 on any one person's credit card. So kind of as informational, but we're giving you the list of employees, those who have, we want to have that limit, those who are below that limit. We've increased several of these and you'll see they total more than $140,000. That's okay because it stops at 100. It's just kind of a first come first serve, but this allows us to start to try to put more on credit cards. Cause as you call, part of our moving to Zions was so that we would get rewards. Because when we were with Wells, we didn't get any rewards for our credit cards.
And this is specifically cash back.
And this is cash back. So last year, as we started in the Zions Union, we got about $2,500 back in January. So we're going to try to maximize that a little bit more now that there's a reward for it. So that's why some of these balances are a little higher. We're going to try to put as many kind of monthly routine type charges on credit cards as we can. Along those lines, as you recall, last year in the check register, we added to if there was ever a charge for more than $1,000 on a credit card, we called it out specifically in the check register, and you could see the line detail. So there's been discussions since we're going to push more that way to try to make some transparency so you guys feel comfortable signing the check register. There's a couple of different ways we could do this. We could include this spreadsheet every month. This is all the credit card charges by each credit card holder, where it was spent, and the dollar amount. For example, on this one, you'll see the ones that are highlighted in green. If you scroll down just a little bit, Chris, there's like two of them. Because those are the ones we called out specifically in the check register, the $1,500 and the $3,100, because they were more than $1,000 as a single charge. We could drop that down to $500, or we could include this. And this would probably be a little easier for our accounting department. And then you just kind of scroll through. Oh, I see, you know, Steve Anderson. It's on the next page down. You know, he bought this and this or whatever. So kind of, would you like this included as we start to push more into credit cards? So you can kind of see what each individual charge is. Do you only want charges over a certain amount that you can see?
How much detail do you want?
Yeah.
And this is work that's already done. This isn't creating.
So this doesn't duplicate anything. It's a spreadsheet you already made.
So. Yeah, I think if you can deliver us something that's not putting an undue burden on you guys, that's probably.
That would be nice.
I have to say this is the easiest for us, and it gives you as much or as little detail as you want to look at.
It's going to grow. It's going to get to be more charges on
there. Yeah, and it will get to be more charges.
So then that kind of makes sense that we used to be able to see them in the check register. Now we can see them over here.
Yeah. And now that I think about it, what we'll probably do, this is sorted by person that the credit card holder. What would you like it sorted just by amount? So like the highest amounts are at the top and then you can just kind of scroll down to be like, okay, I don't need to see anything under $100 or whatever kind of thing. We'll include it all, but just kind of, we can sort this different ways, I guess is what I'm saying. So.
Oh,
or do you like it by credit card holder?
I'm fine with it the way it is with by credit card holder.
Okay. All right. So you'll start to see this kind of as part of that check register consent agenda then on a monthly basis.
Great.
Oh, so we do need approval of the $100,000 credit limit if you feel comfortable with that for the company.
What was the $140,000
you said? That's the total maximum.
Total maximums we're going to allocate because we can't allocate more than our credit limit. It's just that our credit limit stops at $100,000. And Zions confirmed that we can do that because it's kind of, they refer to it as a first come, first serve. If we hit $100,000, we're done.
What's the limit now?
$100,000. We could look to expand it, but we haven't spent more than $30,000.
So what are we...
But then why does this, but it is 140 because you've given everybody a maximum amount.
No, that's the maximum. So the organization has $100,000. We've allocated more than that, but we will never be able to spend more than $100,000. So if Steve makes 10 charges for $10,000, no one else will be able to use their cards.
Why do we need to change the $100,000?
We don't. We didn't. We're just keeping it the same.
But they just said it's 140.
No, that's
the idea. No, it's the total of 140 if everyone spent everything, but everyone's not going to spend their entire
budget. Get rejected after 100,000 aggregate.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you're asking for it to be increased to 100. I mean.
No, it is 100.
What are you asking for, Steve?
I'm asking for you to confirm it at 100,000 that we had before. And that's all you really have to approve. The bottom portion is just to kind of so you can see how we do that. But like 1 month, Andy may need to put 10,000 on his card and I only need 1,000. But,
Okay. Are we, is that the question there?
This has never been more than 100.
Yeah. Total.
I understand what you're saying, but I'm just saying.
We kind of talked about this in that meeting where Zions will let us to set limits that would add up to more than 100,000, even though our limit is really only 100,000.
Should we say that? Should we approve that? We've assigned 140,000 to people, but we can only hit 100,000. That's what we're approving.
That's what you're approving.
I think we should be approving.
The board only needs to approve the credit card limit. It's up to my discretion on how that limit is allocated by policy.
But we've allocated these dollars. Okay.
I have some questions. No particular order again. Has anyone abused the credit cards that they have now?
No, it's they're really good about it. And, like I said, we've never spent more than $30,000. So I think even with what we want to start to add, getting up to 100,000 is actually kind of be hard for us. So that's why I don't think we need to extend that limit yet. Maybe by next year we'll say, oh, we've talked to Rocky Mountain Power and they'll let us put this much of our power bills. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? Like, unless we find a vendor who's willing to take a lot of money on a credit card, which most of them aren't because they have to pay the credit card fee. But,
I mean, it's just another way for us to generate revenue.
Okay. My second statement is, I'd really like to see that breakdown. I like that very much.
Okay, we will provide that then. So, sorry to make this more confusing than it needed to be, but it's as if you and your significant other each had a credit card with a $10,000 limit. But together you couldn't spend more than 15,000. That's kind of what this is. Like we're saying overall, we can't spend more than 100,000, but we want to have some flexibility between some individual cards because they may be up or down depending on the month.
That makes sense.
Okay. So if the board would recommend that we approve or the $100,000 credit limit with Zions Bank is what we're asking.
Right. So do we have a motion to approve the $100,000?
Yeah, we have to confirm it every year.
Approve it every year.
Sorry, Mike. Yeah. It's part of this annual meeting.
Gotcha. That's okay. Thank you. I move that we confirm the annual change to the credit cards to $100,000.
Okay. Do we have a second?
Second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. That's unanimous. Okay, and then our favorite part of the whole year, Dave allows us to learn about the board training and.
Sorry, do they have to approve Andy as the district clerk and me as the treasurer as well?
No, that's set by policy. Yes.
Okay.
It's set already in your government description.
Thank you.
So this is your required annual training.
Can I ask a question? There's another training too, isn't there?
Open Meetings Act, great.
Right. So
that's Margaret that does that once a year.
She'll be busy suing the state though, won't she?
Maybe.
Are we in violation for closing that door?
No.
So. Maybe.
If you move your cursor over here, just left click, does it work?
Other side. Right here, maybe?
Yep.
Okay. So this is what we're going to talk about. special service district, your roles and Andy's role, and a little bit about liability and immunity.
That's the best part.
That's the best part, right? You know, I gave this presentation last month to the special, the direct district, and that's where they had most of their questions. There are two kinds of local districts that are not municipalities, cities, or counties, and they are special service districts and independent local districts. Summit County has 13 special districts and 13, says 12, but we now have 13 independent districts. And generally, a special service district is a dependent district. The independent districts, independent local districts, are, as they said, they're independent. And we'll talk a little bit about what independent means. Independent means in a second. Special service districts, those are the kinds of services that special service districts can do. And generally what we're talking about is municipal type services in the unincorporated county. And for the most part, the intention of the state was, if you're providing urban levels of services, you should be in a city. But that didn't necessarily work out in all areas of the state of Utah. And as a result, there's been a proliferation of special service districts to provide those kinds of urban municipal services in unincorporated counties, portions of counties. So you've got areas in Summit County and Weber County and Washington County. Those are the three main ones that have a good portion of their population. In Summit County, the majority of the population lives in the unincorporated area and demand municipal type services. So you see how special service districts can provide some of those things. And I've kind of highlighted the three main ones, water, recreation, and fire protection. They're dependent districts. They're dependent because whether it's a special service district or a local district, they're created by the county legislative body. But once the county legislative body creates a local district, it's independent of the county and the county's legislative body. Dependent districts are not. They're still dependent districts of the county, and the county legislative body, in our case, county council, remains its overall governing body. Now, that governing body delegates powers to an administrative control board, which is what you guys are, and to an executive officer, which is what Andy is. These districts are subject to the Local District Act. They're also subject to the Fiscal Procedures Act for local districts, which discusses how you budget. It's subject to the local district audit reports, the reason why you have an audit committee. Also the Personnel Management Act, the reason why you have a personnel committee. Collection of service fees and charges that allows you to regulate those fees, but requires a public hearing. And you're subject to the Utah Procurement Code. And that's unique because counties and cities are not. So you will notice that in your policies and procedures, they are based upon the Utah Procurement Code, but they have some special things, limits and other things that are particularized for the district itself. There are certain duties that the county council cannot delegate to the administrative control board or executive officer. Annexations, which is the reason why you make recommendations on annexations to the county council. The designation of public works contracts subject to Title 11, Chapter 39. It is a bid and noticing requirement that luckily has been stripped out of the state code in this legislative session. And it's been, it is a process that, because of SyQuest, which is the state's bidding system, has made this obsolete, and nobody's been following it for years because these requirements of you, you know, posting in three places, you know, your bids.
Newspapers.
You had to do all these things. And now you only have to use SyQuest state. And now the statute says that you just use SyQuest. Property taxation. So Mountain Region does not have a property tax, but if you wanted to have a property tax, you would give a recommendation to the county council, and the county council would have to put it on the ballot. And then depending upon what the residents within the district decided, the county council could impose a tax and increase that property tax through truth in taxation, but it's not something they can delegate to an administrative control board. The same way with bonding. Any bonds have to go through the county council. You know, the county council's role, as I've said, is the governing body. It appoints and removes administrative control board members. And that's an old photo. I'm still waiting on their new photo.
I was just going to say, you need to update that.
Yeah. The council consents to the hiring and discharge of the executive officer. The county holds the EMS license for the entire county. Doesn't really apply to you, but it does apply to all the fire districts. It requires an interlocal agreement with the county for legal services and HR, which is the reason why I'm here. The reason why David Warnock is on your personnel committee. And there are certain things that over time the county council has taken back from administrative control boards. Personnel is an interesting one because it undelegated that power to the administrative control board, but then really granted it back through a letter of authorization, which basically says you need to keep David Warnock in the loop.
Does that show up in the bylaws? Is that...
Yeah, it's in the bylaws. It's in some other places.
Personnel policies.
Yeah. And it's one reason why the county wants, in terms, it used to be that all the districts had all sorts of different personnel policies from the counties. And the county wanted to make sure everybody's was consistent. But there are some differences here and there, but they wanted it all to be fairly consistent across all the county entities. The budget, you make a recommendation, and the county council actually approves the budget. Bylaws, policies, procedures, regulations, as we've said, you recommend, the county council then approves. 99% of the time, whatever the administrative control board recommends, the county council will end up doing. But there is that 1% time that they don't. And, you know, and that's sometimes uncomfortable. If you recall one time several years ago in terms of water fees. Eminent domain, they reserve for themselves. Real property, that only applies to the recreation districts. Basically acquisition of recreational open space. And direct litigation, that is a legacy of Mountain Regional Water. But every time I've asked the council if they want to redelegate that out, they've said no. So there you go.
We're okay with that.
funding and finance. These are the ways that special service districts are financed. You know, fees for service, that's what mostly Mountain Regional does. And property taxes, that funds a lot of the rec districts and the fire districts. Special service districts cannot impose a sales tax, but you can impose impact fees. And you can have general obligation bonds and revenue bonds. And that's how all of the special service districts are funded. So you have an idea that it's really pretty diverse. Some have a tax rate impact fees. Some have tax rate impact fees and other fees. Some just have fees. You know, some does bonding and some of them don't. So it's pretty diverse. So now we go to the executive officer. In your case, his role in terms of supervising is he supervises the district heads and other district officers under him, approves all the personnel actions, obviously assistance of the county HR, the attorney if need be, controls and directs the prosecution, defense, and settlement of all civil lawsuits, you know, with the assistance of the county attorney and, in your case, with the county council. Issues executive orders. Keeps the board updated on all matters pertaining to the district. His financial role is the district's purchasing agent. He can delegate that to somebody else under him, obviously following the procurement code, executes contracts, county attorney approves as to form, presents proposed budget to the board, acts as your risk manager, applies for grants, and approves all expenditures and warrants up to whatever the limits are in the board's procurement policy. Asset manager role, you know, in terms of construction, alteration of district facilities. So, you know, we get the CMGC in place. And you approve it, we sign the agreement, but that doesn't mean that you just forget about it. Andy's still in charge of working with, in this case, Oakland, to make sure it's built and built within budget and interface with the architects and so forth. Controls all the assets, real property. Develops a capital facilities plan, which you have to approve and then recommend to the council, and the council has to approve, and then he implements the plan with his staff. Purchases and disposes of all real and personal property. I've already talked about recreation districts with regard to that. He has a liaison role. It used to be that the county didn't talk very much with its special service districts, and that has changed over time. And now there's a lot of interaction between the districts and the county and also the cities and other special districts. And, you know, Andy, as your general manager, acts as that liaison and as kind of the public relations officer, unless he designates that to somebody else. But the county has a PIO that is willing to help out if need be. Regulatory role, obviously, enforces all compliance issues. You are a service provider for purposes of all subdivision plats, where you're going to provide the water service. Custodian of the minutes, prepares the rules and regulations for you to look at and consider. Resolves complaints.
Why is that in a different color?
That's because those different colors are important. It means that, you know, when there's a complaint that comes in, it's squarely on Andy's plate. To resolve the complaint, to inform the board if it rises to that level.
Complaints, just not from customers, but grievances or...
Or customers. Ultimately, you know, yeah, I mean, ultimately it is, you know, the buck stops there. And he's got a staff to help, but he's ultimately responsible for resolving those and for doing it on your behalf and letting you know, like I said, if it's serious enough, it needs to go to your level. Comply with grandma, appoints a grandma officer under those meetings. We can help, our office helps with that as well. You have to renew your registration annually now. The Administrative Control Board, there is something called the Little Manual for Local and Special Service Districts. It's a nice little resource that you can get from the state auditor.
We can get your copy too. It's online.
Yeah. It goes over a lot of this stuff. Your regulatory role. One of your main regulatory roles is you basically make recommendations on all the bylaws, policies, procedures, any regulations involving Mountain Regional Water. You make those recommendations to county council. And like I said, 99% of the time the county council is going to do whatever you've recommended. And the whole purpose of having your administrative control board is that each of you have some expertises, and those expertise, they're going to rely upon. You can also sit as an appellate body to hear certain appeals from those rules and regulations and procedures. The biggest one is the bid protest. If you had, you know, one of the other failed bidders for this, you know, CG.
San Luis.
Yeah, I always get that messed up in my dyslexia. But anyway, if you have somebody who's unhappy, they can submit a bid protest, and you would then hear that bid protest. You recommend organization master plans to the county council, and you attend the Open Meetings Act training each year. Financial role. You recommend the district budget to the county council. So processes, Andy presents a tentative budget to you, and then you make whatever changes you're going to make, and you recommend that tentative budget to the county council. And then the county council will hold a public hearing and ultimately pass your budget. You recommend a capital facilities plan to the county council. You recommend any tax levies, which you guys don't have, but you could recommend an election to have a tax levy if you wanted. You conduct the financial performance audits through the audit committee. You exercise financial oversight of the district, which is the reason why you look at the warrant list of all the expenditures all the time. You recommend parameters resolutions for bonding to the county council. You impose the impact fees. I mean, this is the unique thing, is that the capital facilities plan has to be approved by the county council. But the ones who actually take that capital facilities plan and impose the actual impact fee and the impact fee analysis is the Administrative Control Board. And as part of that, you set your fee structure. So you set the fee structure and you have a public hearing for your fees. But, and that's usually done in the budgetary process, but it's the county council who approves the budget. And you can approve investment funds under the Money Management Act. Supervisory role. You can veto hiring decisions that Andy makes. You can veto any executive orders he makes. You conduct his performance evaluation. You are his boss. And they appoint and discharge Andy with your, the advice and consent of the county council. You can serve as an appellate body on personnel actions. So you serve as a career service council, or you can use the county's career service council. We offer that to all the districts. Here's an important aspect, and that is you as a board and as board members cannot direct individual employees of the district to do things. You act through your executive director, through your general manager. So, you know, Mike can't call up
Sam
and say, hey, the hydrant in front of my house is going.
Kids are hot.
You know, hit Davenport over here immediately to shut this thing off.
Have some fun.
Yeah. You have to go through the general manager. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that each member of the administrative control board acting alone doesn't have the authority of the administrative control board. The administrative control board acts in public meetings on a, you know, specified agenda. You take a vote and that becomes the act of the board. And so your actions are to direct Andy, your employee, to do things. It's up to Andy to decide how he's going to do it and who of his staff he's going to, you know, he's going to send out there. Because, you know, your fire hydrant is jumping up. He may say, well, I don't want Brian to go out there. Steve, you go out there and fix it.
Yeah.
You know?
May not work out there and fix it.
May work. You never tell. Don't sell yourself short. Your governing body role, you're the principal policymakers in the district, and you have an oversight over everything that's happening. As I mentioned before, you know, the board expresses its decision by majority vote in a public meeting. It's important that when you take votes, especially if it's a controversial vote, and you're on the wrong side of that vote, and the media asks you for a comment, your first statement should be, the board decided X. Then you can say, you know, personally, as a member of the board, I voted Y and there's a reason why. But you should make a distinction so that they understand that this is what the board said. And even though I'm a member of the board, you know, I didn't vote for it. That's still the board's decision. So now we talked about liability and immunity. Absolute immunity are for legislative actions and you can't be sued. So that's pretty plain on its face. There's something called qualified immunity, and that's when you're acting in an administrative role. And when you're acting in an administrative role, you have qualified immunity from suit, so you can't be sued unless you violated a clearly established right. So if you violated somebody's clearly established right, you could lose your qualified immunity. So what does that mean exactly? Well, one of the things that it means is that there is a safe harbor provision, and this is where your attorney comes in. And our job as your attorney is to give you guardrails in which you can make decisions. Stay within the guardrails, whatever decision you want to make, make it. But don't go outside the guardrails, because those guardrails are that clearly established right. And as long as you follow that advice and make your decisions within those guardrails, even if I'm wrong, you still have qualified immunity. That's the safe harbor rule. Or the stay in your own lane rule. So what's the difference between legislative and administrative decision making? So you know whether you have absolute immunity or qualified immunity. If you're creating something, it's usually legislative. If you're applying it, it's administrative. So it's important to know what hat you're wearing when you're on the board and you're making a decision. So if you were approving the budget or recommending the budget, or you know, you're making recommendations on countywide policies and regulations, or recommending a tax, you're acting in your legislative capacity, and you have absolute immunity. So no matter what you do in proposing your budget, no matter how people might get upset at you, you can't be sued individually or in your official capacity, because you have absolute immunity. On the other side, if you're applying your law or regulation to a specific property or person, a ministerial acts in terms of negotiating a contract, and you generally are not negotiating contracts, that's something your staff does. But if you're approving buying and selling property, or you're making other personnel decisions, you're acting in an administrative role. And that's where qualified immunity comes into play. Something separate and apart from immunity is, when does the insurance carrier have to act? So anybody can file a lawsuit. Certainly if you have absolute or qualified immunity, we can get that lawsuit dismissed, but you don't want to pay the legal costs involved in doing that. You want to be caught, you want to be backed up by our insurance carrier. And the rule in the state statute is that as long as you're acting within the scope of your employment and you're not doing things with malice, you're going to be covered by the insurance. And so it could be that, qualified immunity doesn't apply, but you still be covered by the insurance carrier in terms of monetary liability. The key is malice. And you all probably think of malice differently than attorneys think of malice. Malice is a legal term of art in this case. And it means a wrongful act with the intent to inflict injury. And you may say, okay, well, that's never going to be a problem for me. And that's the reason why you have open meetings act training. Because this is the easiest way to basically be found acting with malice. So, and that's the reason why open meetings act training is so important to have, is because you can do things in an open meeting that you don't think is malice, but it may be looked at as a court as malice, because you have to have a quorum present for decisions. You can only close meetings for certain limitations. Your agenda has to have reasonable specificity on the topic that you're discussing. You have to post the notice. You can't discuss other things that are not on the agenda unless it's, you know, it's a raised by a member of the public during your, you know, open public comment section, or the presiding officer, so Karen in this case, could allow it. But what you cannot do is you can't take action on the item that's not on the agenda. And the reason people get caught up in this is that last thing. And let me give you an example. Happened in Summit County. Happened in 1989. Although this case took like 12 years to resolve. And it happened in Colville. There was just one planning commission at the time, Summit County Planning Commission. It was the end of a long night, and they had finished all their business, and they hadn't dismissed yet, and they were just kind of chewing the fat with each other. And a member of the public came in, and he was friends with all of them, and he came in and said, you know, I just want to make sure I'm going to do X. I just want to make sure that, you know, that you guys are okay with it. And they just kind of talk around each other and go, yeah, we're fine. Yeah, we're fine with that. You go, okay. And left. And he built the Utilite facility in Echo. And the county was sued partially the Open Meetings Act because he claimed he got permission from the planning commission. Something was not on the agenda, and none of those planning commissioners thought anything of it. They didn't think that was malice, but they took action on an item not on the agenda. It's a wrongful act, and you could easily foresee how that Utilite facility may inflict injury on all the neighbors around it. So that is a case study in why it is we harp on the Open Meetings Act. Obviously, if you wrongfully violate the law, the easiest way to do this is your attorney gives you the guardrails, and you decide, well, I'm not going to take that legal advice, and I'm going to go outside the guardrails. That can be viewed as malice. So if you're going to go outside the guardrails, you better be sure you're right. The Civil Rights Act, there's something called 1983 Civil Rights Actions. It is one of the easiest way for individuals to sue governmental entities and sue individuals in governmental entities. And it generally is, you know, centered upon discrimination, but it's where acting under the color of state law, and you all are because you're the administrative control board, you deprive an individual of their rights under the United States Constitution or federal law. Like I said, it's generally discrimination. The Governmental Immunity Act is not a bar to bringing that action, and punitive damages can be assessed against public officials. Luckily, you know, most of these civil rights cases are not successful, but it is out there and it is used. A couple words on ethics. Conflicts of interest, that's another legal term of art. It means that you have an interest on some decision on a financial level, or a familial relationship level. Gee, I know my neighbor, and this is going to impact my neighbor. That's not a conflict of interest. I know these guys, I've known them for years, this may affect them. That's not a conflict of interest. Conflict of interest means it's going to affect them, and he's my son. It's going to affect me because this decision is going to result in a monetary loss for me on my property or something like that. So it's got to be one of those two things. If you've got a conflict of interest, talk to me beforehand. You'll need to disclose it, and then you'd excuse yourself from any decision making, which generally means you leave the board meeting until that discussion and decision has been made, and you can come back.
Would it be a conflict if a board member were to participate in the Flip the Strip program? As long as they're treated equally?
As long as they're treated equally, that's not an issue. Other conflicts, no matter what they may be, you can just disclose them before you make a decision, but you can still participate in the decision making. Remember, in terms of acceptance of gifts, anything that could influence your board decision making, don't do it. You can generally accept non-cash gifts of $50 or less. There was a time where lobbyists and others would do strange things to make all sorts of things, including box seats to the Jazz game, be less than $50. Those loopholes have been closed. Although, as I've said, the base rent, you know, the value of a Jazz seat now may be under $50. So, but just remember, nepotism, so no direct supervision of relatives. Board members can't be employees. Now, technically, the IRS would say, well, you're employees because you're getting a stipend of the district, but you're not considered employees under Utah law. And that's what we're talking about. So, you know, whether it's Steve or Chris, they can't decide, well, I'm going to get appointed to the Administrative Control Board and be on the Administrative Control Board and still have their positions in the district.
What if they had a spouse or a child that, I guess that wouldn't apply to the board.
It wouldn't apply to the board as long as there's no direct supervision over that relative. It wouldn't be nepotism.
So you're saying it's my spouse be on this board?
It's not no, because it's where you're only supervisor. Yeah. Or they're your yeah. person yeah. supervisor.
But could my spouse?
Yeah, because
yeah, your spouse probably could.
It's only him that we supervise, okay. right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So that's your training.
And does Margaret notify them on the open?
Yeah.
That's well done. That's it's starting to sink in, maybe.
Every year I add something new. So.
Well, and that's why if three of us are expected to show up to another meeting, that Lisa has to notice it. Because if three of us are in the same place at the same time talking about anything, yeah.
And you have to notice it.
Does that include the bar?
Well, that means if for some reason we ran into each other at a party, we could not talk about Mountain Regional business because yeah. that would be considered a violation of the meeting set.
You can have chance social meetings, so you can, you know, sit down, break bread with each other and have social functions, but yeah, you can't discuss the business with the board.
So when you're all sitting in the box right. seat at the Jazz game.
Right? So two right. people on the board can talk board business.
Correct. But not three.
That's why at times we've had just two of you in to discuss a certain topic, because then we didn't have to notice it. For example, I think we did that with Karen and Ian when we were talking about plan expansion at some point in time or whatever kind of thing. Because then it's not a board meeting, we're just talking business.
Okay, what else do we have on the agenda here? Do we have any questions on the department updates?
I didn't have
any. I had a couple. One was for Lisa. Do we need to make any changes to the way we notice meetings now that there's been that new state bill?
Not for the way that we notice these meetings now.
And then just the other thing, Anna, I noticed that like your report used to say like how many requests that we had for like title closings like the previous year. And now it just shows like the previous month. And I was just.
Oh, and then the year to date.
Yeah.
We can go back to yearly.
I just think it's an interesting point of reference, especially, you know, in light of Steve's reports, to just kind of see what kind of activities in the marketplace are we seeing a lot of
compared to the year
transactions.
Before.
And,
yeah.
Did anyone else have any questions on the updates?
Joel,
not even the pictures from Brian.
That's right.
Yeah, that was a fun leak up on Bear Hollow. It was deep.
Here, I have a couple of other questions.
Okay.
Just not on department updates, but on the timeline and how we're doing on the capital facilities plan. Because when we were talking about impact fees and if the office costs were going into the impact fee analysis, because they have to be in the capital facility plan to be in the impact fee.
So we have a lot of engineering studies being done with Jacobs, with Bowen Collins, working with our architect. So we are moving toward getting those so we can get the IFA, IFP. I mean, all of these things are going to come to a head this summer.
Okay.
So that is what we're working toward to give us enough time to review and then get them into our budget for next fall. We have some pretty aggressive timeline out there with the various engineers that are working and the architectural firm that are working. That should all come June, July. Our master plan, some more information on the plant. We have to decide, you know, what's our next line replacement. We need to look at a tank up a little draw. I mean, we have a lot of things that are out there.
Chris, do you have that timeline? Was it in the packet? Didn't we just have an audit presentation? What did we just?
It was just about a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just had Dana in like a couple. I feel like just a couple of meetings ago.
Yeah.
Almost a year.
It was a year ago.
We did the, you know, the state fired annual, you know, roles and responsibility fraud assessment. Is that what you're thinking? The fraud risk assessment. We did
maybe
that. We did that at the end of the year. But Dana was here a year ago.
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, we're almost 4 months into this year, Mike.
Dana's up here. Mike was here.
So if you look at, we're hoping to get information June, July, to start to bring to give Zions. Bowen Collins is doing a piece to give Zions a piece to bring it in September. To get us to then October and then a presentation. So the latter half of this year is going to be busy.
I mean, you kind of get a breather here at the first of the year.
Yeah, you're getting a breather.
Yeah. Well, and then
Sam, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's full gas right now with us trying to get
it. Yeah, I got like January, February.
Yeah.
March.
And then as we dig into the strategic plan.
Then it's.
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of a domino of all different things that are going to come together for 2024. And then what we need to do is, you know, 5 year, 10 year.
So BoCo's work isn't Is that included in here, or the where are those?
So internally, on the staff side, Colin's report, we're going to start seeing parts of that within the next month or so, but their final report's not due until.
Yeah, we're all working back to charge a new impact fee next year. So we need to get the IFA adopted by the end of this year.
On this timeline, we have September, our September meeting for revenue discussion and IFFP work session. So the impact fee facility plan has to be done first. In prior years, we've done that internally. Now Bona Collins is doing it. And then we would do the impact fee analysis, which then informs us of what the actual impact fee will be. Like Dave meant, these are approved by two different entities. So the board approves the rates, but the county council has to approve the impact fee facility plan. So we need, once we have the work session with you, we're going to need to go to county council in order to get the impact fee facility plan adopted, which then creates the IFA.
Is the impact fee facility plan the same as the master plan?
No, it depends from the master plan.
Yes. So when is the master plan? You were saying that
later this summer. I know it's June or July, so we need Jacobs to do their piece to get Bowen Collins their piece, which will then give them the information they need to do the IFPD. Yeah.
Okay, that was all I had.
Okay. Joel, did you have any questions on the department updates?
He's saying no.
Okay. Then if there's nothing else, we will stand adjourned at 8:12.
It's still like-